Good afternoon. We'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. The time is 1:02 p.m. on Wednesday, January 22, 2020. Resources Committee members present are Representative Hannon, Representative Tallarico, Representative Rauscher, Representative Rasmussen, Vice Chair Hopkins, and myself, Co-Chair Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. And assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, as well as Jordan May, and LAO moderators Amanda Kraft and Taylor Kelly. I don't see any other legislators in the room. Everyone, please silence your cell phones for the meeting. This is our first meeting of this legislative session, and I'd like to welcome members back to House Resources. We've had a change of committee aide in the interim, and this session will be assisted by Rose Foley. Thatcher Brower will continue to be co-chair TARS committee aide this session. Resources Committee will meet this Friday as well. On that agenda, just for members' benefit, we will introduce a committee substitute for House Bill 27 regarding the regulation of flame retardant chemicals. This bill was heard twice in committee back in April of last year, and the CS and other documents for that meeting have been distributed electronically to all of your offices. The intent of the committee is to introduce the CS Friday and hopefully get any amendments to co-chairs by Sunday at 1 p.m. so that we can discuss them Monday and potentially move the bill Monday. As a reminder, the policy of the committee has been to require amendments be submitted at least 24 hours before the hearing which the amendments are to be moved. Today's agenda, we have a presentation on the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation from Mr. Joe Dubler. This will be the first time the corporation has been before the legislature since our July update. In addition to Mr. Dubler, we also have Frank Richards on the line for questions. Mr. Dubler, thank you for being here, and if you could please state your name and title for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, it's Joe Dubler. I'm the interim president of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. And in addition to Frank online, we also have Matt Kissinger for any commercial questions that come up. And we timed out. Rose is going to fix it here. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for inviting us to testify today. There's a lot of good things going on at AGDC. We're getting a lot of important work done, and we appreciate the legislature's interest in it. We'll do our best to give you a thorough update. And if there are any questions, feel free to stop me in the middle, wait till the end, whatever you'd like to do. We'll answer your questions.
I think we'll ask members to hold questions until the end of a slide, just to kind of keep pace.
Thank you.
The slide or the presentation?
Slide.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chairman, the first slide we've got is kind of an overview of the corporation and how we got to where we are. I know everybody on the committee was here last year, and this may not be necessary, but there are a lot of people in the public that haven't heard from us in a while or haven't paid attention in a while, and I think hopefully we're gonna continue to work for the state, and I think reminding people how we got here is a good start. So in 2010, House Bill 369 instructed the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Mr. Chairman, if I don't define acronyms, just raise your hand and I'll try to remember that. Like most businesses, we live on acronyms, and it's frustrating at times, but anyways. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to conduct a pre-feasibility study of a small diameter pipeline from the North Slope to south to Fairbanks and south central Alaska. This was a result of the perception at the time, and I say perception, at the time it wasn't a perception, we thought it was the reality, that the gas reserves in Cook Inlet were dwindling faster than we could replace them through new drilling or whatever the means for achieving new resources in the Cook Inlet for the South Central region, as well as to truck to the Fairbanks area for the, what's now the, I believe, the IGU. Is it? No. So we started working on that. I was on the original project in 2010. We're down in the post office mall in Anchorage, about seven or eight of us working. We did a one-year study and said it would cost, I think the number we came up with was about $10 billion. And at the time, that was seen as an infrastructure project to bring gas to South Central so the residents, the lights don't go out, and we don't end up having to import or rely on other countries or states to provide our energy. In 2013, House Bill 4 created the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC, which is the corporation that I work for, and also created in Alaska Statute 3125 the enabling statutes that give AGDC the broad powers that it has. And the legislature, and I participated in a lot of those hearings, was very concerned about having politics come in and change the project or push the project one way or another. So they gave very broad powers to the board to allow it to act autonomously from political pressures that are going on in the state. In 2014, the producers at the time, Conoco, BP, and ExxonMobil, had been working on separate projects between them, and they came together to work on the Alaska LNG project. In 2014, Senate Bill 138 gave AGDC the authority to represent the state in that project. At the time, Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue were both representing the state, and it was a little concerning to the producer parties that the regulator and the taxing authority were going to be working as a partner, as it were, on that project, and they pushed for AGDC to get involved as the state's pipeline company, and the legislature passed and the governor signed that bill into law. So we began working on the AKLNG project, the joint venture agreement we negotiated, and in 2016, at the time, TransCanada was still involved in the project through its work on the AGEA license that they were awarded, and I don't know the date of that, but that was several years before the 2016 date. TransCanada had a interest in the project. Basically, 25% of the project was their portion. The when AGDC took over.
Sorry, Jeff.
No problem, Representative.
Sorry about that.
I guess I have donuts.
Is it donuts or bagels now? I can't keep track. So we AGDC took over 25% interest in the pipeline portion and the gas treatment plant on, or GTP, up on the North Slope. Excuse me, TransCanada had that. AGDC was only the LNG portion at the end. TransCanada being a pipeline company and the GTP and the pipeline were better suited for them, and the AGDC took the LNG facility. In 2016, we bought them out of the rest of the project, and we represented the state's interest in 25% of the entire project, not just the LNG. In 2016, the pre-front end engineering and design, or pre-FEED, effort was completed. The results weren't that attractive at the time. The numbers that they were producing as far as the ability to deliver gas into Asia at a marketable price, it didn't work. The amount that the price in Asia would have been significantly higher than the market, and therefore it wasn't going to be a project that was going to get built by the private sector. At that time, the producers backed away from the project, and the state took over 100% and continued working forward. During the last couple of years, the AGDC focused on market participants to come in and try to provide the financing. There are a lot of different things thrown at the wall, and it's still, the economics still just weren't there. In 2019, last year, I came back to the project with a promise to look at the economics, to see if we could update the cost figures and see if this is a project that's going to be competitive on the world market, because that's what it's going to take for something like this to get done. And we also committed to completing the regulatory portion of of the project in at FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. FERC, we're in a position now. They've issued their draft environmental impact statement, or EIS, and we're expecting a final EIS in March of this year, and a permit to proceed in June of 2020. So that would be the end of FERC's process, and we would have the ability to continue on. What that will give the corporation is, and the state, and I use the two interchangeably. I see myself, even though I work for a separate corporation, I see myself as a state employee. I represent all the people and not just a few. I represent the people of the state, just like everybody on the committee. Probably not as well as you guys do, but I try. In 2019, again, we focused on the Alaska LNG project. We had been working on ASAP as well. We got a record of decision and a permit to proceed with the ASAP project. The problem is at $10 billion, that project doesn't pencil. It just, I mean, if the state wants to do it, if we ever did run out of gas in Cook Inlet, you could take that thing off the shelf and build it as an infrastructure project, just like you would a railroad or a road or a bridge or anything else to provide gas to Alaskans. So that is still an asset that the state holds and retains through AGDC. So all wasn't lost on that effort. It still is available.
Any questions at this point?
Or
Rasmussen?
Thank you. I'm not sure if it's going to be addressed later on in the presentation, but what's the next step after the June FERC process is completed?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, it's actually starting long before June, and that's a very popular question. I've heard it a few times already today. We're currently looking for third parties to come in, invest, to lend money for the project, to actually build the project, to own the project, and operate the project. That's something that the state, and I've said this a lot, and I hope people believe me, the state's pretty good at some stuff. Building integrated LNG projects is not one of them. You need somebody that's done this before. These are basically three mega projects. The North Slope facility is in excess of $10 billion. The pipeline's in excess of $10 billion. And the LNG facility is well in excess of $10 billion. Those are three huge projects that anywhere else in the world would be a big deal, and they're all rolled into one. So that's not something that the state's going to take on, or that the state should take on, and the governor's very adamant about that this is not going to be a state-led project. So what we're doing is we're looking for those parties right now.
Quick follow-up. Is the state planning on retaining any ownership in the project, and what are the kind of percentages that we're looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I can't answer that question at this point. We don't even know if the project's going to move forward. If it does, these projects they tend to get done with an alignment between the gas that's going through a project and the ownership of the project. So the state will own, depending on a few things, up to 25% of the gas, somewhere around there. So the state could own a quarter of the equity, or could invest a quarter of the equity in the project. That remains to be seen if that's an attractive opportunity. There's 61 people that get to decide that, and one of them isn't sitting here. So it'll be a decision for the policymakers at some future point. But it is possible to invest in a project without, taking a significant amount of risk. That reduces the amount of your reward, as we all know how investing goes.
Rip Hopkins.
Thank you. Thanks, Joe. Following that June 4th date that Representative Rasmussen was talking about, assuming it goes forward and you have a good financial estimate, do you see AGDC having to staff back up at all to bring on some of that additional work as you move forward?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I do not. The role of AGDC going forward is not going to be as project sponsor. We're not going to go back up to 40 or 50 people where we're actually doing the work and we're acting as the entity responsible for the project. There's going to have to be a third party step in and take that over. AGDC's role will be that of representing the state's interest in that project. In other words, Any company that invests in a project, you don't just write checks and you know, call me when it's done. You have people that are on board doing things like commercial negotiations. If you're doing structuring the transaction, you know, you've got to come up with the appropriate debt and equity ratios. You've got to come up with the appropriate term on the debt, the type of debt you're going to issue. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered. So I would see that AGDC assuming that role instead of one of a leadership in the project, and it would be in representing the state's interest, whether that's coming up with the equity dollars or the state's portion of the debt.
Would you need to retool the structure you have? You see the team you have right now just ready to go on that entirely different type of project, or how would you foresee staffing going?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, we would have to see at the point in next June what the state's role is going to be, if any. Again, I'm not assuming that this is going to continue on in June. We'll have to see what the project cost projections come out at, and if they come out relatively attractively, I don't think we'll have any problem getting some parties to come in and participate in a project that looks like it's going to be competitive on the world market. And if it is, the role for AGDC will be relatively limited, because if they're running the project and they're the lead and they're taking most of the risk on the construction and the operations, the input that the minority partners have, while it'll be important and you'll get your 25% worth if that's the percent you're putting in, it won't be one that requires hundreds of people on a staff. There could be a dozen, two dozen. I don't know at this point. Mr. Chairman, the activities from last year, since I took over in January, again, we shelved the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, or ASAP. That's sitting on the shelf waiting for an entity to come up and either have some interest in it, or the state to say, hey, we need gas to Fairbanks. We need, you know, there's a mine halfway down that we can construct a pipeline to provide gas to. Some entity to step in that has an interest in seeing that go forward for some other reason than straight profit making, because the costs of that project are such that it will not make a profit at current gas rates. So the ASAP project is sitting there ready to go if somebody comes up and would like to take advantage of it. We also reinitiated the stage gate process for the Alaska LNG project. We'll get into the stage gate in a couple more slides and go into a little more detail. Basically, it's just a reasoned approach to a project. It's stopping along the way and saying, okay, from what we've seen so far, does this still make sense? And what it does is it prevents you from getting three quarters into the construction and going, you know, this isn't going to pencil now. You should know that before you start spending the real money, the money that starts with B's. When you start getting into billions, that's where you're taking risk and you're not really in a position to pull the plug if you've got $10 billion into it, you know, into a $20 billion project. It's a little difficult to pull the plug and walk away from that. It's a lot easier when you've only got $500 million. $500 million's a big hit, don't get me wrong, but you'd rather stop there than after you've spent another billion. And so that's what a stage gate helps you do. It helps you focus on the appropriate decisions at the appropriate time and determine whether or not to continue with a project. We also focused our activities in the past couple of years. We've looked a lot at marketing. You know, we had staff going to Asia a couple of times a month, you know, just on marketing tours and talking to people. That's all well and good at a certain point in the project. This project, in my view, isn't at that point yet. It will be down the road. So what we did is we pulled back that activity, cut that down quite a bit, and we're not doing that now. We're just focusing on FERC. That's the important part for us. De-risking the project from a regulatory standpoint is the most important thing we can do right now, because investors, in most instances, are not willing to take regulatory risk. I don't know if you guys pay a whole lot of attention to oil and gas and the regulations in the lower 48. There have been a lot of projects that get killed because they can't get the permits. You know, this state won't let you do that. If you look at BC, even in other countries, BC's having problems with the First Nations. They can't get pipelines over to the coast from Alberta. and they're having problems. So if we can take that off the table for an investor, it's really going to help them be able to make a positive decision, if a positive decision is warranted. The we've also committed to evaluating the competitiveness of AKLNG. What we've done so far, when I was here last year, we promised we'd be looking at costs to update them. The last cost numbers we have are 2015. We held a workshop in Houston middle of last year with our engineers, BP engineers, and ExxonMobil engineers. And from kind of anecdotal discussions I had with some of the participants, they had never seen that many high-powered people meet together on one project at one time. So it was these guys aren't phoning it in, is my point. They're really putting an effort in to ensure that if this project is going to work, they're going to have a pretty good idea pretty soon. We've also then, the outcome of that review was there was quite a bit of consensus among the engineers that our costs, which at that time were estimated at about $43 billion, and resulted in a tariff that wasn't going to compete in Asia or anywhere, but that those numbers were significantly higher than where they thought they should be today. So after those discussions we had, we went out and procured a contract with a large engineering company that did the original estimates on the project under the JVA, joint venture agreement, and they're going to update those numbers to 2019. So we'll have December 2019 updated numbers. That'll give us a pretty good idea by the second quarter of 2020 whether this project will have a competitive possibility or not, at least if it's in the ballpark. So that's what we've been working on. That'll be completed in the next few months. The last thing that we've done is we're committed to soliciting private sector firms to build, own, and operate, and that's going to be something that's a little tricky. This is a very large project for any company. I remember when we were negotiating the original joint venture agreement, one of the producers felt that this project was too big for anybody. You know, that it should be split in three, and we may end up doing that. That's one of the decisions that'll be made down the road by the board, is how to most effectively market the project to potential investors.
Questions at this point? So I've got a question on item one. The record of decision and the right-of-ways, like how long are they good for? So how long will the project be ready to go, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding, and Frank's on the phone, he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the permit is good for the length of construction, and I believe on this project it was 5 to 7 years. So if you go to start within that 5 to 7 years, and let's say you wait 4 years and something comes up and we want to build a project now, then you'd have to go to the Army Corps in that instance. For AKLNG, it'd be FERC, and say, look, we're going to start this project. We're building it. We need an extension, and they could grant you an extension at that point to complete the work that you needed to do.
So that was my question, was with regards to the ASAP project, but right. That 5 to 7 year window is also true for the AKLNG.
Mr. Chairman, I will punt that one to Frank. Frank, if you could address the both the difference between the Corps and FERC as far as the time frame.
I'd be glad to. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Frank Richards, the Senior Vice President of Program Management with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. For the ASAP project, Joe did indicate that, yes, we do have the Army Corps and joint BLM record of decision, as well as the 404 permits and then the right-of-ways across the state and federal lands. Those authorizations are normally good from anywhere from 3 to 5 years on a major EIS, or environmental impact statement. The issue would be whether or not you were actively conducting any additional work on that project, which would potentially add additional times to that. Right now we have, as Joe said, we've packaged all the work up on ASAP and set that aside. So that means that the clock is ticking on essentially the the value of those permits to Alaska and to Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. So what's different between the two projects, between Alaska LNG and the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, is two different federal agencies, even though they're both conducting environmental impact statements. For the Alaska LNG project, FERC, or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is the lead federal agency. When they provide an order to construct an LNG facility, they ask the proponent how long it's going to take to construct. And so in our case, from initiation of work to completion, it was going to be about 8 years. So the order for the Alaska LNG project, we feel, has got a sound life of 8 years, unless you were continuing to do additional work, and then FERC would keep that order open. So 3 to 5 years for the ASAP project for the environmental impact statement, and then approximately 8 years for the Alaska LNG project.
Okay. Then my next question regards to item four. Who's updating the economic analysis on that?
Mr. Chairman, that'd be Fluor Corporation. They're a large corporation. I believe we're working with them out of is it Houston, Frank, or is that Orange County?
Again, Frank Richards, for the record, Fluor is utilizing their expertise from their Houston offices, as well as Elisa Viejo outside of Los Angeles and their offshore offices. They're able to pull together their most recent engineering and cost estimating data for major projects, including LNG projects. So that's why they were selected based on the most recent experience in constructing and advancing those projects. But other participants in the work are, again, both AGDC, ExxonMobil, and BP. So we're utilizing the resources of the main project proponents, as well as the most recent information coming in from a large engineering, procurement, and construction contractor.
And were they also the group that did the analysis in 2015?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, the work that was completed at the end of 2016 under the joint venture agreement was led by ExxonMobil, and the cost estimates were done, as Joe described, with three main sub-projects. So Chiyoda Corporation did the LNG plant, Willie Parsons did the pipeline, and AECOM did the gas treatment plant, and then ExxonMobil pulled all three of those estimates together. But Fluor has worked for AGDC and developed the cost estimates for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, but then also been used as a subject matter expert in doing reviews of portions of the Alaska LNG project for project sponsors.
Okay. And is it possible to sort of briefly summarize some of the reasons they saw such high cost estimates? Did costs change in the last 5 years, or was there something about the analysis that they thought could be improved and find cost savings, or both? Or
yes,
Chair, Representative Hopkins, the review that we conducted, as Joe described, in April of 2019, was a top-to-bottom review of the execution plan and the cost estimate that was developed under the joint venture agreement led by ExxonMobil. So at that juncture, we looked at all the ways that the project had been presented and costed from not only the delivery of the products and parts of the major plants into Alaska, but also looking at how it was going to be executed and where there might be opportunities to reduce the cost. So what we had seen on a worldwide basis was that there have been significant increases in the use of modularization of large facility constructions, so whether it be on the Gulf Coast of the United States or the Yamal Peninsula in Russia or other major projects, oil and gas projects around the world, modularization is a significant way to reduce the cost per ton of facility by having it constructed in individual fabrication yards in Asia and then brought to the site and stitched together with local labor at the individual project sites. So modularization is one of the main components where we see that there are significant cost opportunities for the Alaska LNG project. The gas treatment plant on the North Slope was always a modular construction because that's how facilities up on the North Slope have to be built, because there's only an open water window of approximately 3 to 4 months to be able to bring materials and supplies in for those large facilities. But the liquefaction facility in Nikiski was originally designed with a smaller amount of modular construction and a larger amount of on-site construction, which quite frankly increased the cost. So that combined with some of the commodity prices for major equipment and processing units were other opportunities that we'd like to take ourselves avail to. And then also looking at the way that the project management team that was presented by ExxonMobil was quite top-heavy in regards to the number of personnel that would be filling out that project management team to oversee the what are called EPCs, or engineering, procurement, and construction contractors. So the conversation was around ways to reduce the overall cost, not only from the people building on the ground, but also in terms of oversight.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on this slide? Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an overview of the project that just shows, you know, it starts at Point Thompson on the right up on the top of the map, and there's a line from Point Thompson to Prudhoe Bay where the main gas treatment plant will be, and from there the 804-mile pipeline from the North Slope to Nikiski, and it'll be relatively close to the existing Kenai plant. The producing fields, this will tell you part of the components of the cost. On the fields on the North Slope, 500 to 1,500 people as a peak workforce during construction. The gas treatment plant, again, on the North Slope, you look at the required steel, 250,000 to 300,000 tons of steel, and a workforce for construction of 500 to 2,000. Those seem like a broad range, but there's going to be a few different things that go into that. One of which is what Frank talked about, is the modular construction. So to the extent we've got a more modular construction to get this project competitive, because at the end of the day, I mean, we'd all like to hire 100% Alaskans and not make anything anywhere else but in Alaska. But when the project's done, it's got to be able to compete. And other projects around the world everybody's doing, you know, I hate to sound like a bandwagon guy, but that's what's getting projects done around the world, is modularization. And the reason it is you can get it done in other countries with cheaper labor, and you ship it to the slope and you install it. They've been doing that on slope since the TAPS days. That's what the sea lift is every year. I can remember I came up in 82, and it was always a big deal, the sea lifts, you know, whether it made the window or not, and sometimes they'd have to turn around and go back. This is the exact same as we've been doing on the slope for years. The pipeline, it's a 42-inch steel pipeline. The pressure will be greater than 2,000 PSI. It'll be maintained with compressor stations, with a head compressor station on the slope, and then several along the route. The length, I said 806 miles. That changes, I think. We'll be shipping 3.3 billion cubic feet of gas a day. To give you an idea of what that, you know, the equivalency of that in Anchorage and the South Central region, we burn about 250 million cubic feet a day. So we're talking about a significantly less amount than what this project will do for export that we use in state. There will still be available 500 million cubic feet for South Central or other in-state use, if it's mines, if it's Fairbanks, if it's wherever it is, that there's still going to be excess available, because the pipe and the gas treatment plant on the North Slope are sized a little bit larger than the LNG plant, because we had to accommodate what we needed to accommodate gas for in-state Alaska. So that's why that was done, and there will be gas available. The liquefaction plant will produce up to 20 million tons per annum, or MTPA. There'll be three trains, and a train is just it's basically a self-contained unit. So one train, two train, that's how you expand, you add a train. But you look at the peak for workforce there, 3,500 to 5,000 people. And I think that was it, I think that was with the original stick built concept. I think that'll be less if we do more modularization. And again, 100 to 150,000 tons of steel. So the price of steel actually drives the cost of the project significantly. You can see with all the steel in here, the pipeline, 600,000 to 1.2 or to 1,200,000 tons. I guess that's 1.2 billion tons. That's a lot of steel. And we're talking about, we just talked at our last board meeting about how that's going to work, whether it's going to be rolled somewhere else and brought up here round, or whether it's going to come up flat and be rolled up here. And that's something we're working on as well. Cost will go into that as well.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Because you put it on there and it had me thinking that the price of steel is, you know, clearly listed here because it must be a major component of it. Over the last 5 years, what's the price of steel done to our predictions to bring it online? Because we keep talking about the totality of what this is going to cost, but we know with variety of tariffs and other world productions, the price of steel varies. Is there any expectation in the next 10 years that the price of steel is going to go down? Or is it driven completely by if we do some modularization and buy the steel somewhere else that we get a better deal on it? Expand on that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the amount of steel we're purchasing for this project is so large that we will find the best price on the steel that we can get. There's been some indication that I know in the past, 3 or 4 years ago, the big push was, well, we need American pipe, we need American steel. And at that time, there was not a manufacturer in the United States that could produce pipe this big. We believe there are now, and we believe this could be sourced in the United States, which would, at least on the finished production side, make the tariff debate kind of moot. As far as getting the steel, if the steel comes from foreign, of course, we have to pay it as well. But that's exactly why we've hired Fluor, because this is what they do around the world every day. And they will be able to tell us, look, you should be in India, you should be in Germany, you should be wherever. This is where you should be sourcing your steel, because it's. I think the quality isn't an issue as much anymore as the price is. And so we're going to be shopping, again, the more of something you buy, the harder you got to work to make sure you get the best price.
Can I do a follow-up? Which is just, so help me, several years ago, doing a house renovation, want to do a bunch of stuff, steel, happened to be at the peak price of steel at the height of the Iraqi war, and couldn't afford any steel. Went with man-made products instead. Lots of plastic in the house. Lots of PEX piping, no copper, all those kinds of things. So not just getting the best price of steel, because clearly you would be buying a high enough volume that you can negotiate. You've got some room there. But what does the steel market look like? Because I assume that timing-wise, we have some predictions about when steel's going to go up, when other projects of major scale are being built, and when, once they're geared up, you know, so are there five other projects that are going to drive the price up, but people are going to scale up to produce that steel for them? And gosh, if we're coming in just at the end of those projects, hey, somebody else already built 42-inch pipe and now they're geared up and you had to pay the big price, but we're coming in next, so we're going to get a better deal. Is there a subset in your sector that follows that exclusively and timing-wise?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there is not currently. We have cut staff back significantly in the last year. And, you know, we have not tracked that to my knowledge, and Frank maybe knows more about this, but I would just like to address your point about other projects and what's coming online. That's kind of an elusive target, because if you listen to the press, this project was going to make a final investment decision last year. This is what we were telling people 3 years ago. Final investment decision in 2019 with start construction in 2020. So if you believe that and you modified your project based on that projection, you were disappointed, because we weren't anywhere near an FID, and we were, I'm I'm pretty sure we're not going to be starting construction this year. As a matter of fact, I'd bet my house on that. It's not going to happen. We're looking at you know, 2-3 years down the road at best, if this thing is economic. So as far as what the price of steel is going to, there's so many things that go into the price of steel. Price of energy is one of the biggest, because you've got to transport all the raw materials. You've got to actually, you know, melt the steel. You got to make the steel. So if you could tell me what the price of natural resources and energy was going to be in different countries around the world, it gives you a better idea. We don't have that accurate of a crystal ball. That's why, again, we're using a third party. That's what these guys do. That's what the Fluor folks do. They will provide us with the best information they can provide us, and where we're going to rely on that information.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chairman, this is just another slide showing the components of the project. We're on slide 5, if anybody's online watching. But again, a gas treatment plant of $10.7 billion, a pipeline of about $14 billion, and then the LNG facility of just under $20 billion. And those are all 2015 cost estimates. Those will be updated in the next few months. That's exactly what I was talking about. And you can see down at the bottom, if we make a final investment decision, a positive final investment decision, it would occur likely in 2022, because there's a significant amount of additional work that needs to be done in the front-end engineering and design, or FEED stage of the project, before that decision is teed up to be made. Large projects like this, you don't make decisions unless you've got a lot of good information and stuff that you can verify. And we will not have that this year, and we will not have it next year. I mean, there's a lot more engineering that needs to be done before we're able to come up with those numbers.
Or Fannin.
Thank you, through the chair. Just to make sure I know your vernacular, first cargo means a tanker leaving with gas in it.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's correct. Okay. And the reason we make that distinction is there's a time frame between a first cargo and full production, and it's because you typically bring them on. We talked about trains. You bring on a train at a time. You don't just flip a switch and all three trains are up and running and off you go. So you'll start with one. You'll bring some gas down. You get you work out all the kinks, and you get things going. It's usually I would estimate between a year and 18 months before you get to full commercial production from the first cargo. Okay, Mr. Chairman, slide 6. This is the stage gate process slide that I talked about earlier. All this is a reasoned approach to progressing a project. It forces you to stop at predetermined points to analyze the situation on the project and make a positive decision on whether you want to move forward or not. And basically what it prevents you from doing is what what used to happen a lot, and that's you get started on something and you just keep going. You've got the money for the project, and unfortunately, there are a lot of large state projects that work like this, because they're infrastructure projects, right? So you're building a road, you're fixing the road between Talkeetna and wherever, pick a place, and you can't. That doesn't really lend itself to this type of approach, which is why when the state took this project on, we said we're not going to do it like a road to wherever. We're going to do it like an industry-led effort, and that's where you stop and you analyze the project and you make a decision whether or not to move forward. And in this case, you can see there are three stopping points. The FEL, all the terms in here, you don't. This was just to show you that there is a reasoned approach. FEL means, Frank, can you help me out here? It's been a long time.
FEL is front end loaded.
Yeah, there you go. Front end loaded. I'm sorry, I just drew a blank. Front end loaded. And again, you're loading the project, the cost up front that will help you determine if it's going to be competitive. So instead of just on day one saying, well, let's get those bulldozers, and I always laugh. Wally Hickel's Road to Cordova, how are we going to do it? Let's just get bulldozers out and just start making a path and build a road. when you do things like that, you get three quarters, half the way into it, and you realize, oops, we forgot about that fault, or there's that glacier, or there's, you know, whatever. And then you got to back up. And once you get that much money invested in a project, if you have to stop it in the middle because you're paying interest on all those funds, you're paying your equity holders, you're paying everybody. If you've got $5, $10, $15 billion and you got to stop for 6 months, you'll kill the project. I mean, it's the difference between making a project and not making a project, not making it. And it's just something to avoid. So a reasoned approach like this prevents that, and it ends up in a lot better results typically. Just have to throw that.
Rep Rauscher.
Yeah, through the chair. When the middle column where you're talking about, I believe it's development risk. Is that it? De-risk, is that development risk?
De-risk is just de-risking, reducing the risk, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Rauscher. It's just de-risking means you're just taking risks off the table, and that's what we're doing now with FERC. We're taking the risk that we can get a permit to build this off of the table by actually getting the permit in hand.
And then through the chair, follow-up, along those lines, what's your projection on the FERC end of it and the state's permitting end of it and on down the line? How many years? You got any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, before it's completed, I can guarantee you that.
That would be good, right?
Yeah, it's going to take several years, and we'll get to the slides in next that show all the, show some of the major permits. There's thousands of permits that are required for this, and I was shocked when I've seen some of the smaller ones. It's hard to imagine if you've never worked on a project of this magnitude that covers this amount of space. Most projects, if you're going to build a new facility on the slope, you have to deal with everything on the slope and right around it, and above it and below it. But that's it. We've got one on the slope, we've got one down here, and we have 806 miles in between that we go across rivers, we go through salmon streams, we go across fault lines, we cross bridges, we go through over mountain ranges. So there's every single one of those has its own issues, and every single one of those requires some type of permit.
We have a few slides coming up that describe a lot of that too.
Okay.
Feel free to follow up.
Yeah, I just wanted to know how far along we were on that.
Sure.
Rep.
Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious if you have kind of a rough estimate at each of these phases or around the stop sign how much money the state would have invested roughly.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, the FEL2 was before pre-feed. I don't believe the state, before we went into the pre-feed effort, I don't believe the state had any funds invested in AKLNG at that time. So the first green circle up there, it was zero. I think over the years, if you count, DNR and Department of Natural Resources and some of the other folks that had worked on permitting for the various efforts that have gone over the past 40 years, if you counted those, I have no idea how much that is. I mean, people apply for a permit. We've applied for permits to all these agencies, and we're paying typically, if you see our budget this year, we've got RSAs with the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environmental Conservation to fund the effort that they're going to have to put in on our behalf. So if there's costs like those, I don't have any idea. That was well before, and I'm not even sure the state could come up with those because it's people's time and it's that kind of stuff. The pre-feed joint venture agreement with the producers, I believe we spent approximately $150 million of state funds. We also paid off TransCanada when I mentioned earlier we bought them out of the project. And I believe that was, if I remember right, and Frank, can you help me, was it $160 million?
Through the chair, this is Frank Richards. Through the GEA process where the state of Alaska was paying both TransCanada and ExxonMobil expenses for the Alaska LNG project and actually through some of the concept selection work, I believe the numbers are over $320 million.
Okay. So again, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, that the 320 was both TransCanada and Exxon, so they were 50-50, but TransCanada's was 160. The at the next stage, the feed effort, we've had quite a bit of discussion about this because it was in the original joint venture agreement, the concept was we would complete the regulatory effort during feed. We've completed a good deal of that effort during pre-feed, so it won't need to be done in feed. The original estimate was about $1.5 billion for that effort to go from the second or the middle green one to the right green one, about $1.5 billion. We think it's going to be significantly less because of the permitting that we've acquired in the last two or three years. So somewhere in that, the numbers I've heard thrown around about $800 million to about $1.2 billion, somewhere in that range. And then execution, then you get into, you know, if it's going to be $25 billion, it would be the state's portion of that. The 800 to 1.2 is the entire project, and the numbers I've been giving you are the entire project. The state's portion of that would be whatever the state determines its role in the project would be. If the 61 people decide we don't want in, then the state wouldn't be putting any money into that. I don't think that's a likely scenario. I think, but if the state put in a quarter and it was, let's say, $1 billion, $250 million for the next stage.
Thank you.
Rep. Hopkins.
Thank you. And just for my own information, and maybe if there's anybody watching at home, about where are we on this timeline? Are we looking somewhere around the feed stage in the yellow box in the middle? Is that...
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, that's exactly where we are. We're at a feed decision. We're preparing for a feed decision right now, and that's putting together a decision package that that basically outlines what has happened to date. You know, the cost, the engineering effort that's taken place, the permitting that's been acquired, and the permitting that will be required. So it's just a decision package for any parties that would like to participate in the feed.
And then follow up. And then that FID, which I'm guessing is the final investment decision, is sort of that June 4th-ish time frame?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, no. The final investment decision would be a couple years down the road.
Okay.
Feed's going to be approximately 18 months, and then whatever companies are involved in the feed, and again, this is all if this project is economic. I want to keep hammering that in. This is not none of this is going to happen if we come back and they say, and it looks like the numbers are going to produce $10 gas in Asia, that's not going to work. And then that's when we start saying, okay, this one becomes similar to ASAP, and we'll put it up for sale and see if anybody wants to buy it. But I wouldn't think that would be probable. We are very hopeful that that won't be the case and that there is a project to continue on. But and if it does, a feed decision would be a couple years down the road.
Thank you.
Yep. So slide 7 shows just basically an overview of our regulatory program, what we're working on. The pre-feed JVA got us to a FERC pre-filing. Since then, we've been working on the filing. We've addressed just under 2,000 questions from FERC in the last several months. And those are questions from all kinds of agencies, and we'll get to a slide that shows all the agencies that are involved in this project, and it's really mind-numbing when you look at it. But the way the federal government does it so that we as a applicant don't have to deal with 150 federal and state agencies, federal only, I should say, federal agencies. FERC is the lead agency. All the other agencies funnel their comments through FERC, and all of the work goes through FERC, and they take on that lead role as the sponsoring agency for this project. It simplifies the process for everybody. Then all of the little entities all over the country just have to go to FERC. They don't have to come to us and get a hold of us. It just makes it a lot easier. There's been no change to the design criteria in this project from the original joint venture agreement work that we did with BP, Exxon, and Conoco in the 2016 through 2018 timeframe. 2015 to 2017, excuse me. We have used some work from the ASAP line. We did a lot of boreholes. We did a lot of geophysical data, so even some cultural resource data that we used on the alignment for ASAP that we're able to use on AKLNG as well. The alignments are identical for a large portion of the project for the two pipelines. So they run basically down the same easement. It's not easement, down the same leases until it gets the AKLNG project cuts on the west side of the Susitna and heads down the valley that way. And I think ASAP stayed closer to the highway. But other than that, so there's a lot of data we've been able to use for both. Mr. Chairman, any questions? Okay. Slide 8, Mr. Chairman. Here's some of the agencies that we deal with in getting permits for this project. And the acronyms, I'm sure I can figure them out if you'd like to know, but it's an acronym soup. But you can see there's even local, there's quite a few of them. You know, we travel starting at North Slope Borough. We go through Denali, Matanuska. We're in the Kenai Peninsula Borough. It says municipality. I don't believe we're in the municipality of Anchorage, but the gas ends up in the municipality of Anchorage. But then you get, you know, Wasilla, Kenai, Fairbanks, North Star Borough. I mean, there's and those are just the local ones. Up above, we've got to get Coast Guard, we've got to get FEMA, Homeland Security, DOD, I mean Department of Defense. It's pretty amazing when you look at all the input that goes into a project like this. Okay, Mr. Chairman, move on to slide 9. Here's some of the...
Sorry, Rep. Rasmussen.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as far as the state's role in the permitting process, have you seen any areas where you feel there's some overlap as far as places that we could be streamlining processes?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I will again refer that to Frank. Frank's been the one doing the day-to-day dealing with the state agencies. I do know when I mentioned early on that our legislation that was created by, it was written by the legislature to create the corporation, gave us very broad powers. One of those powers was the direction to state agencies and other corporations that if they had a request in on the AKLNG project, that took precedence over anything else they had sitting on their desk. So it kind of, you know, on the federal side, there's a fast 41 that's a list of projects that if the agencies delay at all, they have to actually go to, I believe it's the president, to explain why. This basically gave us the same thing on a state level. That's where if we have a request in the DNR for a to fishing game for a stream crossing permit, they've got to work on that first before they work on something else. So, and with that, Frank, I'll let you kick in if you've seen anything where we could streamline processes at the state level.
Through the chair, again, Frank Richards with AGDC. As Joe described, our enabling legislation gave us a great hand up where you guys directed those agencies to make us a priority for our permit authorizations. And so we have been working with the state agencies where they require us to have authorizations, whether it be the stream crossing or fish habitat permit or driveway permits with DOT. But in the right-of-way area, because we must cross state lands, and whether it be administered by the Department of Natural Resources or the university or the Mental Health Trust or the railroad or DOT, that's when I heard the question, thought, well, maybe there could be some streamlining if all of those particular landowners had a similar process. But again, there's individual statutes that direct those individual agencies on their lands and how to manage them. But again, we're dealing with those agencies trying to get the right of way or easements through their individual state lands across the board. So one-stop shop would have been helpful rather than going through to five different agencies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Slide 9 just shows our schedule and some milestones that we've already achieved and some future milestones. We had public comments in September. I think the last hearing we had here was right before those had started. Those went very well. We got quite a bit of support actually from the communities. One of the biggest issues we're having right now is it's not, you know, that typically you have not in my backyard, the NIMBY folks. We have people more of a yes in my backyard, which is something that projects like this don't experience a lot. We've got the Matsu Borough wanting the LNG facility to be located there, and we've got the Valdez wanting the LNG facility to be located there. So if anything, it's been a fight over, well, how come you won't build it in our backyard, which is a interesting problem for us to have. It's a lot easier to deal with that than it is people adamant about, you know, not building. So that's gone well. We did some subsistence hearings through the BLM. There were only a couple of those, but we've got actually good feedback from some of the villages along the route that were concerned about us, you know, putting a pipeline in and creating access to an area that doesn't currently have access. Through, you know, you put a pipeline in, there's going to be a stretch about 100 feet wide that's now devoid of any trees or alders or willows or anything. It makes it a lot easier to get on a four-wheeler and ride into some traditional hunting areas of groups, and we're very conscious of that, and we're working with those groups. I know we've Minto, the village of Minto is one of the ones that we've been working with. The second chief, Rocky Riley, has been around since I was here before. He's been around a long time on our advisory committee, and we're doing whatever we can to help those folks so that we don't create problems. The draft EIS comments were provided to FERC on October 3rd, and again on the second group of listings are our future milestones. We expect a final EIS on March 6th. Less than 2 months away, and a final FERC order on June 4th, which is 90 days from the final EIS. Those would be really big accomplishments for this project, and I think we'll at least not discourage future, you know, potential investors from participating. It would be an encouraging accomplishment for the project.
Rep. Hopkins.
Just a quick question. You referenced a 100-foot right-of-way for four-wheelers to get access to subsistence land. Is a 100-foot right-of-way what would be standard for the main 42-inch line?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I'm going to ask Frank. Frank, I believe 100, or was it 90 feet? It was somewhere in that range. I rounded up. So it's roughly in that area. And again, it'll end up looking like a four-wheeler trail, but that certainly isn't our intent. And if we need to plant stuff back over or encourage growth or put rocks across it or something, we certainly don't want to cause problems for subsistence hunters.
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, this is Frank again. During construction, the right-of-way is going to vary nominally about 120-foot right-of-way to allow for the equipment and the ditch and the spoil piles. But once the pipe is in the ground and we have tidied up the right-of-way, the permanent right-of-way that we're asking for is approximately 53.5 feet. So that area we will keep, you know, clear of additional tree growth so that we can come back in the future should there need to be maintenance.
Which, Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to Frank's, in the park, Denali Park and Preserve, Denali National Park and Preserve, that's going to end up being a bike trail because we have to clear it anyways, and they're very keen on getting a bike trail through parts of the park, and I think that's going to be part of our agreement with them to go through the park is to provide a bike trail over the gas line. It'll be, we have to keep it clear anyways, or near it at least.
With a quick follow-up, with a bike trail and access for subsistence hunting, is this going to be a publicly accessible right-of-way? Is it trail through Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins.
And to be clear, the opportunity for people to use that right of way for hunting was a concern of people, not an opportunity. So yeah, it definitely wasn't the intent of that right-of-way was to open up hunting access. So I just want to make that clear.
Right. That was an unfortunate consequence, is the potential to open up areas. Mm-hmm. As far as access to the right-of-way, Frank, can you help me out there, too? Sorry.
Yes, through the chair again, Frank Richards. So the access to the right-of-way is really going to be governed by the landowner who is going to be providing AGDC either a right-of-way easement or a land lease. So we have heard from private landowners along the way, and even the federal entities, that you know they have concerns about, as Joe described, issues around subsistence, particular areas or potential sensitive habitats. So we're going to comply with the wishes of the landowners. Again, we will need to, as AGDC or the future operator of this project, would need to be able to gain access should there be needs for maintenance. But again, that's going to be through our landowner agreements. So the concept is not an open trail concept for you know, from Prudhoe Bay to Nikiski. It is going to be, it's an active pipeline corridor.
And Mr. Chairman, for instance, along the Parks Highway as it comes down, when we split off to head to the west side of the Susitna, that could provide access to an area that isn't available right now, whether it's because of, you know, wetlands or because of, I've been out as quite a bit up here as well, alders and willows, and those aren't easy to get through, even if you're walking. If you're on a four-wheeler, there's no way. So this is going to put a path through some of that stuff and allow that. Whether if it's on state land, the state rules would apply to access. I think that's what Frank said. So, okay, Mr. Chairman, slide 10 shows some major permits. And again, I talked before, there's thousands of permits. These are just the big ones. And you can see the Coast Guard, Department of Energy, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. PHMSA is Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration. They're the folks that make sure that the pipeline itself is as safe as it can be. You're still running highly flammable gas through at 2,000 PSI through a steel pipe that is man-made. There are still going to be risks, but the point for PHMSA is to help reduce those risks, and actually it's in the corporation's best interest. Safety is the number one concern in the oil and gas industry. It doesn't do anybody any good if we're out doing things that aren't safe, endangering our employees, endangering the people of Alaska if they're close enough to it. So this is going to be a safe project, and PHMSA is one of the oversight agencies that makes sure that it is. Slide 11, some more major permits. Pipe and pipe is something that is, and Frank, if you could share with them the pipe and pipe. This was an interesting application we made to PHMSA for pipe and pipe, and that's at Nikiski. And Frank, if you want to go into the particulars of that permit.
Yes, I will. Again, through the chair, Frank Richards with AGDC. When a project such as the Alaska Gas Line or Alaska LNG or the Alaska Standalone Pipeline project is going to deviate from the design standards or regulations set by PHMSA or the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, we have to get what's known as a special permit. And so on the preceding slide, you saw that we received four special permits for the pipeline and spacing for mainline block valve and crack arrestor spacing and strain-based design. On this particular case, a pipe and pipe is where we're going to have material, the liquefied natural gas will be in tanks after it's liquefied in Nikiski, and then there'll be a loading berth with essentially two berthing areas down in the water and Cook Inlet. So to get the liquefied product from the tanks down to the loading berths, the original concept that PHMSA requires is that there be a catchment system able to capture the gas coming out of a pipe and then collect it into essentially a sump where it can then be captured and re-pumped it back into a tank. That's a very expensive option because you have to have essentially a very large trough underneath the loading arm and then a backwards trough leading back uphill to a tank. So that was going to be a very extreme, challenging design aspect of the project. So we elected to use what is known as pipe in a pipe. So you can envision a smaller pipe then enveloped with a larger pipe around it. It has both sections of pipe have to be capable of handling the stresses from the very cold temperatures, minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, liquefied natural gas. And that concept has been used in LNG facilities around the world, except within the United States. So when this project started under ExxonMobil, they elected to try this concept moving forward with this. Another project on the U.S. Gulf Coast in Clackamas is now using pipe-in-pipe. So we've been working with PHMSA to be able to get this permitted through their special permit process to allow this as a cost-saving element, but again, a safe element to be used for the Alaska LNG project. Now, the remainder of the permits that you see on this page are essentially some of the large both federal and state permits that we will be receiving over the next 6 months as we conclude not only the FERC process, but all these major federal authorizations. So this will be additional assets in our quiver that will have essentially de-risked the project considerably from the federal permitting process.
Mr. Mayor. Slide 12 is a continuation, some more major permits, and you can see we need to deal with whales not only on the North Slope, but in Cook Inlet, the beluga whale population is threatened, and it's actually declined, I think, in the last year. They just came out with some a little bit ago. So we've got to be very careful on how we deal with the whales during construction and during operations with tankers coming and going through Cook Inlet. Anything else significant? Again, bridge permits right away through the Denali Park and Preserve, the wetlands permit and water quality at the bottom from the state just to make sure we're not causing problems in the watersheds along the route. And again, that's an issue that probably doesn't come up in a lot of projects because you're building a single building in a single place. We're crossing nearly the entire state, and so we're hitting salmon streams, we're hitting big rivers. I think we cross several major rivers. Those are things that this project has that a lot of other ones you won't see. Slide 13 shows a couple more. Bald and golden eagle protection. We had to do raptor surveys, in the spring because once the trees leaf out, you can't see the birds anymore. So those are just some of the things that you learn doing stuff like this that you just don't think about, you know. But we've had to do quite a bit of surveys. We've done air monitoring on the North Slope to get a baseline ahead of the project, and then we'll get a baseline once it's in operations to see what the true impact of the project was on the air quality on the North Slope. So these are just some of the permits that the corporation is working on currently.
Before we move on, the slides on permits answer your questions, Rep. Rauscher?
I guess I just was looking for some time that they had envisioned that the permits would all be in by. That's all.
Okay.
And through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the major ones are the ones we're getting out of the way first. There's a lot of smaller ones that come along the line, but before we begin construction, most of the permits will be acquired because you're not going to start building a project of this size, you know, where you're putting in 5, 10, you know, you have to pre-order supplies, you got to pre-order steel. You're putting billions of dollars into it, and you're not going to take the chance that you don't get a small permit and you can't proceed or you have to stop and wait to get it. That kills projects.
Yeah, and through the chair, yeah, I understand that. I just thought at the end, I got 8 years, 5 years, that we should have them all acquired by then. I'm just looking for
through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I'll let Frank, because we've been working on this now for about this project. We started 2000. Frank, what can you handle that? I'm sure you can.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, in regards to the major federal permits that we've just gone over in the last couple of slides, those are the ones that are going to give us the authorization to construct and to proceed forward. What will come next are going to be predominantly the state and local permits. So we'll have to work with the state agencies and local governments to be able to accomplish those. As we advance the project through the front-end engineering and design, we will have accomplished most of the state and local permits. But again, there's going to be activity on the permitting front right up and through construction. So as we cross both federal lands, state lands, and local lands, there's going to be what we call authorized officers in the field able to address permit conditions as they come up. So part of the regulatory regime that we will have and be following is, again, permit compliance right from the start of construction all the way through operation. So to answer your question, I believe, is when is the major effort going to be done? I would say prior to the final investment decision, we will have the predominant majority of the permits in hand ready to go to construction.
Which, Mr. Chairman, puts it at about 6 to 7 years total acquiring permits, if my math's right.
But that's 2 years from now.
Yes.
So in 2 years, they expect to have all the major permits done, and then there'll be some ongoing.
Yep. Thank you. That's basically where I was headed with it. Thank you.
I talked briefly about the corporation's effort to reduce costs on the project. This is critical to the determination on the future of the project. If we can reduce the costs, or if the costs are sufficiently reduced from the 2015 numbers, we feel that this project has a possibility to be commercially viable. So we're currently working to do that. What we're doing, and I've covered most of this already, Fluor is going to update the current cost, or the cost to current, to basically fourth quarter of 2019. That'll give us the best numbers we can possibly do. There's 10 major tasks that they're working on. It's everything from modularization to sourcing of supplies. There's quite a bit of detail they're going into. Looking at all cost elements, including contingency. One thing about this project, there was a very large contingency in the initial project. The way contingency is calculated is you come up with what you can identify as the cost on a project, and you apply a contingency percentage to it, typically. This one, when those hard costs go down, the contingency is going to go down as well. So if the contingency is 20% of the total cost and your costs go down, you know, $5 billion, well, your contingency is going to go down $1 billion. So that's a big component of this, of the reductions that we're expecting, is being able to reduce a contingency commensurate with the reduction in the actual hard costs. The we will hope to get an updated Class 4 cost estimate, and Class 4 is roughly, Frank, if I remember right, about 15% engineering?
15 to 20%, correct.
15 to 20% engineering. And what that means is, we've done 20% of the design. We haven't done detailed design yet. We don't know where every gauge and every valve is going to go. We know there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a compressor here, and there's going to be, you know, a power plant over here to create the power to run the compressor, and some design of the on the interior. But a lot of it's just going to be very generic at this point. That's what FEED work does. FEED does more detailed design, and once you begin the EPC stage, which is after a final investment decision, and EPC is engineering, procurement, and construction. So the engineering, you would finish up the engineering to about a 90-95% level, and then you'd begin procuring your steel and your components, as well as heavy equipment. The amount of heavy equipment required for a project like this is enormous, and it's not the kind of stuff that's sitting on a shelf somewhere. So you got to pre-order dozers. You got to pre-order the booms that lower the pipe into the trough or into the trough. So The objective for this, again, is to provide data for a decision support package for a FEED effort. That's what we're shooting for, and this will be one component of that.
Rep. Hopkins, and then Hannon.
Thank you. As they're going through and doing these cost estimates, are they including labor costs and what that would be to hire the thousands of people who would need to construct this entire facility? And if they are, how are they evaluating what those labor costs would be? Is it lowest common denominator? Is it prevailing wage? What are they looking at for labor costs?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, they definitely are doing that, right down to the people that are cleaning the rooms in the camps. I mean, this is a complete cost estimate that has every component, cooks along the way, security, you name it, everybody's included, and they're based on prevailing wages, what we expect to pay, which means one of the hurdles that we've got is Gulf Coast jobs. Alaska wages are higher than they're paying in the Gulf Coast. So we've got, you know, kind of a strike against us right from the beginning. We pay higher wages, cost more to build up here, period. And so, but those, we're not using Gulf Coast numbers because that doesn't do anybody any good. We're trying to be as realistic as possible and make the best estimate that we can so that it's based upon on a rational foundation and not what we want it to be.
Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Just for my own edification, so class four estimates is through 20% of engineering. How many classes of cost estimates are there? Is it on a scale up to 10? Because I presume by the time we know 100% of the cost, we've already built the project. And then you've used a term, and I keep missing one word out of it, engineering, procurement, and
Construction,
thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I don't think Frank's wondering if he's going to have to answer this because he knows he will. Cost estimate, class four, class three, class two, those are an engineering designation, and Frank will be happy to tell you what makes them up.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, again, the class four is a nomenclature that is put out by the American Association of Cost Estimators, and it's really based on the level of definition and essentially what's the level of engineering that has been conducted. So when you develop a project and you develop a concept and you do your initial work, you are at a class five cost estimate. And then as you do your pre-front-end engineering and design and complete that level of effort, you can then get some material quotes or vendor quotes coming in, and that really gives you the class four estimate. As you progress into the front-end engineering and design effort and complete the FEED, then you are at a class three level of estimate. The next level is detailed design and essentially contracting with the EPC or engineering procurement and construction contractor. That's at class two with around the FID time frame. And then when you're complete with your project, you've now achieved the class one, so you know what the overall project costs are.
Thank you. And through the chair, I'm really glad I asked because the scale was inverted from how my brain was working it. So thank you.
I have a question on this slide. Is the investment bank identified? Are you already working with someone?
We have been working with an investment bank for quite a while now. It's one that Goldman Sachs.
I was going to say,
which is why I didn't put it in the presentation. But since you asked, and as for those of you who didn't hear, they came out with an announcement that they're not going to support any projects that involve drilling for liquids in the Arctic, which, you know, for it was specifically related to oil, not gas. However, that's As an Alaskan, that, to me, that's kind of offensive, and I'm trying to be nice, but it's something that is a real problem for them to continue working on this project. We've talked to them, and they said that wasn't their intent, that they're okay to keep working on this, and we have continued to work with them. We're still evaluating that, whether that relationship will continue.
Rep. Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a ballpark of the amount of exposure we have with Goldman in investment right now?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we haven't. They've done some work. The thing about the investment banks when they work for you, and finance is my area, so I'm going to answer this one. The engineering stuff is Frank, but the way investment banks work, they don't make any money on the structuring or anything like that. That's just kind of a sunk cost that they put in order to get the transaction where the actual equity or the debt is sold. That's where they make their money on commissions, and big money on commissions. So a bank like Goldman, I believe we had a contract with them not to exceed $150,000. We've probably got $100,000 into that already from the work that they've done over 2 years. So it's not a lot of money. I mean, that's not nothing, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot of money. And they've provided some very good advice. They've provided some very good product that we've used in, like, we just finished working with them on our shared economic model. The Exxon and BP and AGDC came together and created a model to do a projection so that when the costs are updated and when everything's done, we can put them into this model and get some idea at the end on what we would potentially be able to deliver gas to Asia for. That's something that, you know, when it's just the three companies sitting in a room, things look really good, but you want a third party to come in and look at it. Goldman was the one who did that, and so they did kind of a reality check for us and offered some suggestions. That's the kind of stuff they've done. It's been very helpful, and they have been very very helpful to the corporation and to the project. So the announcement was troubling for me because those were a very strong announcement in my view, and it was kind of contrary to the interests of the state of Alaska, and so it was troubling because we have had a good relationship with them, and we would like to continue. Again, we're still evaluating that at this point.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And since it came up again, and when we started talking about this project, the three companies, investor companies, included BP, which we know is selling off the majority of their no-slope assets. All of their North Slope assets to Hilcorp. Does that mean we now have two companies involved in the LNG project, or what? Does BP retain any rights to the future of the project that they've invested in the work that you just referenced, or is that a moot point? Because
it's probably a good time to advance to the next slide, I think.
So. Oh, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, to answer your question, BP and ExxonMobil are not partners in the project. They're very clear. This is a cost-sharing agreement. They agreed to provide funding for AGDC's effort on the project, but they're not. It's not an equity position that they're getting for their money. So what they do at the end of June, when that agreement is up to BP. I don't know, and I don't think they know. Seriously, until we have an idea this project is going to move forward and this project can compete, nobody's going to commit to anything, and they'd be ill-advised to do so at this time. There just isn't enough information, and so at some point in the future, I would assume that all the parties involved are going to make decisions, and it'll be based on the best interests of their company. I don't work for them, so I can't help you with what Hilcorp's going to do. You know, I've talked to Hilcorp, talked to BP, obviously, and I can tell you almost certainly that they're going to do what's in the best interest of their companies, which is what they're supposed to do, just like we're going to do what's in the best interest of the state, because that's our company. So, okay.
Just one follow-up, I guess. And in other oil and gas presentations, when, you know, discussions about proprietary information about seismic data, et cetera. And I don't, you know, that's not as pertinent to gas. And we've talked about the ASOP project being set on the shelf, ready to go. The state could pull it off at any point. So I guess I'm wondering, is there any kind of that kind of technical data that, because they were one of the parties invested in the development of it, that they retain knowledge, expertise, rights to use in the future, even if if it sits on the shelf for 10 years?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, that is an excellent question. The ownership of the data that is going into this project is very, I'm trying to think of the right word. It's confusing because we have a license to use some of the data. We own some of the data. And there's some other data that we're not even licensed yet, but if we need it, we can get a license. So there's different categories of data. As far as the producers, I mentioned a bit ago that ExxonMobil was working with TransCanada on the Aegea pipeline. At the same time, Conoco and BP were working on the Denali pipeline. Both of those efforts accumulated data that have gone in some form or fashion into this project. So we don't own that data. I believe we have a license to some of it. So it's a technical legal issue that will be hammered out. Fortunately, if the parties that do own the rights to that data are involved in the project, it would definitely be, or I shouldn't say it, still own gas on the slope and would like to see this project move forward, whether they're involved or not. It would still be in their best interest to allow us to continue to use that data and produce a product and commercialize their gas along with everybody else's. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of resistance to using that data. Matter of fact, we've got data use agreements in place. But as far as the ownership, it is pretty tangled up. I mean, there's some that, yeah, it's confusing.
Thank you.
Sure. So the... third-party participation, I think the last time I was down here, BP and ExxonMobil had not come into, had not agreed to fund costs yet. We were talking with them initially, and we were able to get a $20 million receipt authority in the budget for fiscal year 20. That amount was filled by commitments from each of BP and ExxonMobil of $10 million apiece. We shouldn't say up to a third of AGDC's FY20 costs, up to $10 million. So, and right now, Frank's going to go through the numbers. I noticed when I was looking through this, the numbers guy forgot to put the budget in there and the spend in there. So Frank's going to go ahead, and I was so concerned about everything else that Frank's going to go through the numbers as soon as we're done with this slide to show you we're significantly under budget, like 50% for this year so far, and we don't think that's going to change very much. So, the initial budget that AGDC prepared last year under the prior administration, I believe, was for $52 million for fiscal year 20. We'll end up spending about 15, and 10 of that will be funded by BP and ExxonMobil. So the state's cost will be about $5 million. We were projecting when I took over to be out of money in somewhere around November, December. We've got about $20 million left in the bank. So we're in a position where we can continue on at this pace for several years without an additional appropriation to the corporation. Having said that, we have in the budget for fiscal year 21 an additional statutory receipt authority of $20 million in the anticipation of a positive outcome on the economic analysis and the ability to solicit investors from the global LNG market, and we're looking for people to come in and put money in. So we put an additional $20 million with the understanding that we can go to LBNA and increase that if we're really good and get more than 20. So that's the plan for next year for the budget numbers. And so Frank, if you wouldn't mind going through the actual spend for the year.
Through the chair again, it's Frank Richards with AGDC. The legislature authorized AGDC for fiscal year 20 for its operations at approximately $10 million. And then the board, through our authority for expenditure process, authorized an additional up to $20 million for capital spend to be able to complete the FERC effort and conduct the work efforts and the permitting process and also the cost reduction. So that gave us an overall spend authority of up to $30 million, and that's how we started the fiscal year. And what we that's the, essentially the budget that we prepared and shared with ExxonMobil and BP, and they in turn agreed to fund each up to $10 million or approximately one-third of the overall expenditure. To date, through November, as reported to the board, we have expended approximately $5.2 million for both AGDC operations as well as our capital spend in advancing the FERC and permitting process. So with additional work that we now have underway with Fluor, we see that our spend rate will increase over the next few months, and then we're projected to essentially have at the end of the year a total expenditure of approximately $15 million, or half of the authorization that we originally envisioned to be. So ExxonMobil and BP are receiving cash calls at the beginning of each fiscal quarter, and they are providing us with those cash reimbursements on a very timely basis. So AGDC is using the money and spending it wisely, following the efforts to reduce overall spend within AGDC and the reduction in staff and expenditures. We are still living within our means and within the budgets that the legislature authorized, as well as what the companies agreed to refund us for.
Thank you, through the chair. And just because we use the term capital in a specific vernacular way here at the legislature, so could you help me understand what your capital authority is in the FERC process? And I assume that it's coming from an investment portfolio use of that term, of simply the money that you've got, that you have access to, as opposed to you're building something for FERC. But I need to confirm that.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the original appropriation to AGDC was a large appropriation into a fund, with the understanding that we could spend money out of that fund to progress the project. We do have to come back to the legislature on an annual basis for our operating budget to pay for salaries and lights and electric and stuff like that. But the actual design of the project, any of those kind of capital expenditures, come out of that fund without an additional appropriation. It's already been appropriated once, and we don't need to go back.
And that includes the permitting?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it does.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation for today. I would like to let the committee know we intend to come back in the next 4 to 6 weeks. We'll be at the Senate resources, and we'd also like to do a lunch and learn for legislators and any interested staffers that would like to come and talk about some things that are of interest to the state relative to the project.
If we're still here in July again, we might get to see your new analysis. Thank you very much.
Let's hope that's not the case.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't see any other questions from the committee members. So thank you very much for your presentation. It's a great way to get the session started for the House Resources Committee. And with nothing else, our meeting is adjourned at 2:40 p.m.